The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. Many listeners will recall the election for president in the year 2000, an election that wasn't decided until quite some time after Election Day because of the Florida recount. It pitted George W. Bush against Al Gore, and it ended up going to the Supreme Court. Well, some people, looking back at that history, blame a third-party candidate for the Green Party, Ralph Nader, with siphoning enough votes away from Al Gore that George W. Bush was able to win the election. 2 years after that election, I interviewed Ralph Nader for his book, Crashing the Party, Taking on the Corporate Government in an Age of Surrender. And he had some very interesting comments about that Supreme Court decision and about Al Gore. He also had some very interesting things to say about a lot of other subjects. Here's Ralph Nader for the Best of the Book Nook as he's crashing the party.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Ralph Nader. He has a new book out called Crashing the Party. Hello, Ralph.
Hello.
Ralph, I understand after being virtually ignored by the media during the last election campaign, suddenly they're all knocking on your door. Now, why is that?
Well, I think because the theme of the book, Party, and a subtitle, Taking on the Corporate Government in an Age of Surrender, focuses on the main power structure that's weakening our democracy and shutting out the people from their own government, and that's corporate power. And I point out in many ways how it affects people's everyday lives and how it puts a dollar sign on everything that should not have a dollar sign on, elections, democracy, government, you name it, and how that has to be a focal point of politics in our country, what to do about the concentration of power and wealth in fewer giant multinational corporate hands. So when the Enron scandal broke, some of the reporters remembered that, and remembered 35 years of advocacy for corporate accountability in the health, safety, and economic area, and they called me. I could have told them I told you so.
You've called it our engine for reform, Enron.
Yes.
The supermarket of corporate crime for our time.
Yes.
It's just the tip of the iceberg, isn't it?
Yes. There are a lot of little Enrons, big Enrons. There have been some already exposed, inflated profits, looted 401k pension plans, investors defrauded. And the federal cop has not been on the corporate crime beat, and both under Democrats and Republican regimes. And the Enron scandal, because it has so many tentacles in so many ways, corrupting everything it touches, and because it's damaged a lot of middle and upper middle income people instead of just the downtrodden, like the workers in Enron and the pension holders and the investors, it is a perfect engine for reform. You know, you've heard about the phrase the patron saint of a reform here and there. Well, Enron can be viewed as the patron devil of reform on Capitol Hill, but it's not going to happen automatically without a big rumble from the folks back home contacting, writing your members of Congress. Everybody's got to do his or her part, even if it's just 10 minutes, because the politicians are going to have a lot of hearings documenting the Enron crimes. They're going to see the media documenting these crimes and the damage to innocent people. There'll be some civil lawsuits to recover some of the money from the fat cat executives. But members of Congress are experts at allowing all this to happen, joining in the denunciations and not passing any fundamental reforms. So we're starting a major Enron corporate crime reform coalition, which can be reached on citizenworks.org. That's citizenworks, one word, .org. And we're having this weekend a brain trust conference with experts and grassroots organizers to hurl into the congressional hopper really fundamental reforms in all directions. The phrase corporate reform, that is, corporate reform, should ring throughout the land, just the way in the past distortions of the phrase tax reform or welfare reform rang throughout the land, because if that occurs, enough people talk it up, corporate reform, no politician will be able to escape taking a stand, one way or the other, on reforming the out-of-control corporations.
My guess is Ralph Nader. Ralph, do you think that our pusillanimous press and our Congress has the stomach and the heart to take this Enron scandal wherever it leads?
No, but they do have the fear of an aroused public still within their breasts and their heads. And that's what we have to generate, that the public is going to say to the senators and representatives, this isn't going to blow over the way you allowed the Watergate reforms for the most part and the post-SNL racket reforms blowing over. In fact, they made the banking laws weaker in the decade of the 90s after this horrendous $500 billion bailout of these corporate crooks, speculators, and mismanagers of about 1,000 SNLs throughout the country, mostly in the West and Southwest. So everyone's got to do their bit. Just 5 or 10 minutes, write your member, tell them this is not going to blow over, and tell your member to check in with citizenworks.org, your senator and representative, Senator Devine, other senators, Vukovich, and others in outside Ohio, and say, these are the reforms that are going to be posted on citizenwork.org in the next few weeks, and this is not going to blow over, and we're not going to forget.
Now, is this an outgrowth of Democracy Rising?
Democracy Rising is another new group I started to sponsor giant rallies of progressive citizen groups and citizens in city after city. We've had them now in Portland and San Francisco and Cleveland and Boston and just recently in Austin and other places. And we have tables, free tables for dozens of local citizen groups trying to improve their community, as well as great speakers and some music. We had Patti Smith at a couple of these. We had Eddie Vedder at the one in Seattle, which had 7,500 people in the Rose Garden. So that's democracyrising.org, and the substantive programs and synergies are at citizenworks.org. And this is an outgrowth of what we've been trying to do for years, which is strengthen our democracy.
So people have the power, and particularly young people. Yet we live in a society where our young people seem to be stamped with corporate logos.
Yeah, there's a great commercialization of childhood, and that goes throughout the economy and throughout every nook and cranny. Now they're commercializing higher education, trying to commercialize the public schools. These corporations are commercializing our government, our democracy, our genes, our genetic inheritance, our privacies, our workplace. You know, they're taking away our rights and our freedoms. We've lost, essentially, most of us, the right to choose our doctor and hospital if we're parts of these giant HMO conglomerates. So the book goes through all this. It's not just a look back at an exciting campaign in all 50 states, the Green Party campaign of Nader LaDuc, and what it means to go up against a rigged system controlled by the two major parties, all the way from the ballot access barriers just to get on the ballot to the exclusionary practices of the debate commission, which they created and controlled. But then it looks forward, and on page 309 in the book Crashing the Party, there's a list of 10 advances for America that are very realizable, the next stage of progress and justice, some of which have already been installed in Western European countries for decades, like universal health care and living wage. So this is a book to mobilize, to galvanize the youth. It starts with the youth, and it ends. The book ends with an appeal and a challenge to the young people of America, and suitably for their internet sophistication. We have a website called crashingtheparty.org where you can keep track of how this book and everything, the commentary on the book, and where it's available. It's in all the bookstores now, but you can get it also online.
Ralph Nader joins us. The new book, Crashing the Party, Taking on the Corporate Government in an Age of Surrender. Ralph, is it true that when liberals have no place to go, they go to the Greens?
Well, we hope so. The Democratic Party has gotten used to, over the years, of telling progressive voters that they got nowhere to go other than to stay home or vote for the Democrats because the Republicans are worse. And, you know, when a party defines itself by how bad the opposing party is instead of how much better their party is, then you know that what's going on is what economists have called protective imitation. That is, the Democrats in the last 20 years' strategy of winning elections is to become more like Republicans in order to beat the Republicans. And the two parties are becoming more and more look-alike, and the similarities between them on major issues tower over the dwindling real differences they're willing to fight over. For example, the Democrats were different on the tax bill last year that Bush sent up, tax cuts for the wealthy primarily, but they didn't stop it. They could have stopped it. When it went through, the Democrats actually had taken control of the Senate from the Republicans after Senator Jeffords jumped ship, and after the Green spillover vote won Maria Cantwell's seat for her in the state of Washington, which as a Democrat made the Senate 50-50 and set the stage for Jeffords. But the point is that the Democrats, where they are different, really different, not rhetorically different, than the Republicans, they're not willing to fight for it. I mean, Scalia was confirmed 98-0 with every Democrat, including Al Gore, voting for him, even though I and others were begging some Democratic senators just for the historical record to vote against him. And they also, the Democrats, made it possible for Justice Thomas to become Justice Thomas with 11 switchover votes to win his confirmation in the Senate, 52-48, in a Senate that was dominated by the majority Democrats.
And Scalia ultimately was the key vote in the Supreme Court decision on the election.
Yes, isn't that coming right back to haunt Al Gore?
Mm.
Yeah, I couldn't get Al Gore to vote against Scalia. And, you know, Scalia never hit his light under the barrel, his candle under the barrel. I mean, he was a extreme right-winger ideologue before, long before he was nominated, and flaunted it during the confirmation hearings.
How much money did Kenny Boy give you, Ralph?
Nothing. not even one energy futures trade.
I shouldn't laugh. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. I'll continue with my 2002 interview with Ralph Nader on the Best of the Book Nook right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO with my 2002 interview with Ralph Nader for his book Crashing the Party, Taking on the Corporate Government in an Age of Surrender. 2 years before this interview, Ralph Nader ran for president on the Green Party candidacy, and some people believe that he cost Al Gore the 2000 election against George W. Bush, but there's always more to the story. 16 years later, Donald Trump defeated Hillary Clinton in the presidential election, and some people blame the Green Party for that, but once again, there's more to the story. Perhaps if Hillary Clinton had campaigned more vigorously in certain regions of the country, like rural Iowa, conservative regions in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, maybe she could have eked out a victory over Donald Trump, but we'll never know, will we? Let's listen now to Ralph Nader, recorded back in 2002. In the book, you express some very bitter disappointment that certain people who you thought would support you did not. Gloria Steinem is one in particular.
Yes, you know, the women's rights leaders were complaining a lot about Clinton Gore and what they didn't move to, including raising the minimum wage, which would help women even more than men, because women often get paid less than men. And they didn't really make a move on that. It's just lip service. And when it came to October 2000, when the call came out from Al Gore to Gloria Steinem, Jesse Jackson, and others, to go around the country debunking our campaign rather than debunking George W. Bush's campaign, I was very disappointed, and I was disappointed with their alleged reasoning. I was disappointed that they were asked to bail Gore out, and they didn't demand any substantive commitments from Gore, even though many of the people who were sent out to debunk the Green candidacy had been burning my ear over 8 years, bitterly complaining about the Gore-Clinton collapse in one area after another. So that's what we call the frightened liberals.
Hmm. And our alleged political representatives really seem to have lost their way, particularly the Democrats. You say this happened when Reagan came in?
I think it started around the 79-80, the latter months of the Carter administration, when the oil crisis hit and the whole deregulation mania was rising, otherwise known as taking the federal cop off the corporate crime beat.
Mm.
It's been a downhill. 1980 was when Tony Coelho, the congressman from California, convinced the Democrats that they can raise as much money from the corporate interests as the Republicans. And that was and he was accurate, actually, but they sold their soul in the process and made themselves more and more like the Republicans. It's interesting that the liberal senators in the 1970s in the Republican Party, like Chuck Percy from Illinois and Jake Javits from New York, would now be considered the right wing, the left wing uh-huh. of the Democratic Party. They'd be considered the left wing of the Democratic Party. That's how deeply the Democratic Party has sunk in surrendering to corporate interests.
Well, the left wing of the Democratic Party is Russell Feingold, isn't that correct?
Yes, and Wellstone.
And Paul Wellstone.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But look, on military policy, foreign policy, corporate welfare, lack of enforcement against corporate crime, fraud, and abuse, the regulatory agencies, consumer protection, the criminal injustice system, you name it, living wage, the Democrats, very much like the Republicans, the only place where they're different is rhetorically on these issues. And those are a lot of issues. If you look at each party and its regulatory practices, indeed, not just rhetoric. The Democrats' regulatory agencies like FDA and OSHA and auto safety were actually worse than they were under Reagan Bush. And under George W. Bush, agencies will be even worse other than Clinton Gore, because the corporate government is becoming more and more powerful, dominating one department and agency and Congress after another in Washington. And that's what we have to turn around. That's what this book, Crashing the Party, tries to alert people to, tries to show people how their forebears took on huge corporate power and prevailed, and we can do so again.
My guest is Ralph Nader. The book is Crashing the Party. Ralph, you remind me of Studs Terkel in that you seem to get more passionate and more liberal as you get older, which is not a trend that's very common in our society.
That's true. There are some people who do get, like wine, they get more progressive with age. And there are more people who start out progressive in their 20s and 30s and then become like bananas. They don't get better with age. Studs Terkel is a perfect example. Where you talk Barry Commoner, the great environmentalist, mm-hmm. good John Gardner. Bless his soul, he just passed away a couple days ago, mm-hmm. The founder of Common Cause. They all got better with age.
Michael Moore.
No. And a number of them. Tony Mazzocchi, the great leader, labor leader, founder of the Labor Party here in Washington. You ought to look up that website. He's doing great things.
Tony Mazzocchi?
Yeah. Okay. He'd be a great interview for you.
I don't know him.
Oh. Well, you see, he's talked to more blue-collar workers in the last 20 years. He's a World War II vet. He became the vice president of the Oil, Chemical, Atomic Workers. He's the one who's brought scientists into issues of environment and worker health and safety. He's the greatest labor leader in the country, and he now is the chief organizer of the Labor Party. He'd be a great interview for you. He's under the Labor Party in the phone book in Washington, D.C.
I'll try to look him up. Now, I've heard a rumor that Michael Moore has a new book that he's trying to put out and that his publisher has literally been trying to censor it.
Well, he did. They did censor it right after 9/11 because they thought it was critical of George W. Bush, and they had 50,000 copies stacked away in a warehouse. He finally sprung it loose. It's coming out this month, And in the bookstores, that book should be right next to Crashing the Party.
Do you think that with Enron opening a little light on campaign finance reform, that they can pass any campaign finance reform that actually has any teeth?
Well, they're not introducing a post-Enron new bill. So what Enron scandal has done is change enough votes in the House to pass a few days ago what's called the Shays-Meehan bill, which is a version of the McCain-Feingold bill that's already passed the Senate. And as everybody probably knows who follows these issues, this bill bans soft money, the multi-million-dollar contributions from corporations mostly to political parties. But it doubles hard money, the amount of money individuals can contribute to candidates for federal office. So I would say it was a single where a home run was needed.
My guest is Ralph Nader. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Ralph's new book, Crashing the Party, Taking on the Corporate Government in an Age of Surrender. And Ralph, you mentioned in the book a number of issues, and we're here on public radio right now, one of the few places where we can have a conversation like this. Yet public radio is under tremendous pressure from various constituencies, financial in particular. And in the book, you mentioned low-power FM. Do you think low-power FM might have been a good tool to put the public back in public radio?
Yeah, I think so. And unfortunately, the national public radio people opposed it, thinking it would produce static. And I'll tell you, the FCC can be criticized for a lot of things, Victor, but it does know its business in terms of the spectrum and making sure different signals don't collide with one another. These are tiny radio stations suited for neighborhoods, community groups, church groups, community colleges. They have a range of maybe 4 to 8 miles. They are not allowed to carry advertisements. They are nonprofit. They don't pose a commercial threat. And yet the giant broadcast lobby crushed the effort of the FCC in the year 2000 by getting legislation, in effect telling the FCC not to issue any more of these licenses. I understand they issued a couple hundred of the licenses already, but they were going to issue many more. We have to get that reversed. And this is really a disgraceful performance because in the House, the broadcast industry got over 300 votes out of 425, which tells you that a lot of Democrats shifted over to the Republican side.
Mm. You also allude to President Carter's attempts to pass a Consumer Protection Agency bill. Are you optimistic that that will ever be enacted?
It's too early to say, but we're optimistic that we're going to introduce sometime this year as a start. This is a simple $15 million a year budget agency that would represent consumer health, safety, and economic interests before the existing regulatory agencies who are overwhelmed by corporate lawyers and other lobbyists. So when the Federal Trade Commission decides to propose funeral rules, it's now in the news, to reduce the ripoff, and people have to pay for funerals, there's nobody representing the consumer. There's nobody representing the consumer in these regulatory proceedings on the FAA and aviation and auto safety and food safety and drug safety. And this was going to be a federal agency that didn't regulate anything, just intervened, challenged, produced the evidence for strong health, safety, and economic standards. And a huge gang of corporate lobbyists in the late 70s narrowly defeated it in the House of Representatives. We would have won if Jimmy Carter actually tried to lobby members of the House, but he was otherwise not attentive.
Mm.
And we had the votes in the Senate. And ever since then, it was never reintroduced. It just shows you that the Democrats have very little resiliency once they get whipped.
My guest is Ralph Nader. Ralph, I'm old enough to vaguely remember the 1960 debates between Nixon and Kennedy. This was a very close election. Some people feel that Kennedy won the election based on his performance in these debates. And I have to think that if you were allowed to be involved in the debates with Gore and Bush, that the election might have turned out differently.
Well, certainly we would have been able to reach the 98.5% of tens of millions of voters that we couldn't reach, even though I campaigned in all 50 states day after day, spoke to the largest paid audiences filling the hugest arenas in the country, like the Target Center in Minneapolis and the Madison Square Garden in New York, even though I had a 35-year track record of achievement, and even though our agenda of the Nader-LaDuke ticket was dealing with subject matter ignored routinely by both Reagan, by both Bush and Gore, subject matter that related to the needs, necessities of the American people, and subject matter that had been discussed by the press in prior months. So it wasn't like coming from Mars. It dealt with protecting the consumer dollar, protecting the pension dollar, cracking down on corporate crime, living wage, labor laws that would allow workers in low-income jobs like Walmart to have a chance to form a trade union, getting rid of the bloated military budget, waste, fraud, and abuse. All these have been the subject of articles in television stations, programs, but ignored during the debates and during the campaign by Bush and Gore, including, I might add, corporate welfare issues. And we were not allowed on the debates. And the Debate Commission is a private corporation. It's got a government-sounding name, created by the Democrats and Republicans in 1987 to replace the League of Women Voters, which they viewed was being uppity and wanting to have its own mind about what kind of rules and debates formats there would be. And they've kept everyone out except Ross Perot, who Clinton wanted on because he thought it would hurt Bush, and he was right. And ever since then, they've never had a third-party candidate on. And during the year 2000, as I point out in my book, which is full of these stories, very interesting, major national polls were conducted asking people if they wanted me and Buchanan on the debates, and a majority of the people wanted. Mm. So they didn't want the debates to be a cure for insomnia, I guess.
Well, the majority doesn't necessarily rule, Ralph. Are you looking... I know it was a huge decision for you to run in 2000. Are you waiting to see what the Democrats do in regards to Enron and other things before you decide if you might throw your hat in 2004?
Well, it is too early to say about 2004. After all, you have 2002. We'd like to see a lot of Green Party candidates run for local election. Anybody listening who is upset about the Board of Education or Development Authority or the City Council, for heaven's sake, call up the Green Party and throw your hat in the ring. It's, at the local level, the Greens can win. They won 25% of their local seats last November. So that's what I'm focusing now in terms of politics.
My guest is Ralph Nader. The book is Crashing the Party, Taking on the Corporate Government in an Age of Surrender. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Ralph, I know you've got some other things on your schedule, and you've got a busy schedule, so I just want to make one more comment. You make a statement in the book that really resonated with me, and it's this: become good ancestors.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, we all get our civic motivation to better our societies from various sources, some from our parents, some from our perceived sense of injustice that we observe, and what we read, see, hear about. Some from our forebears in terms of all those great people who, with virtually no power, took on the slavery, took on the disenfranchisement of women, fought for women's right to vote, workers' right to form trade unions, those farmers who gave us the greatest political reforms in our history after the founding fathers in the late 19th century, early 20th century, to launch the progressive political movement, first against the giant railroad abuses and the banks. But I think possibly the greatest source of motivation comes from, what are we going to say to our children and grandchildren? This tormented world of ours, when they say, why did you pass it on the way you did? What were you doing in the meantime? Mm. Why didn't you take a stand, lift a finger, an arm around the shoulder? And, you know, it's very, very distasteful to have to say, well, we were too busy, or we didn't think we mattered. We didn't think we had the time. We didn't think we had the power. So that's why I say become good ancestors. So you can answer when your grandchild said, how did this good thing that you passed on to us, this condition, this opportunity, this freedom, this justice, how did it get passed on to us, you could answer them in terms of what we did, what our generation, it's our generation's time to put our arm on the wheel of justice. And that's the way the book closes in Crashing the Party. It's a good book for college graduate students, other young people who tend to get discouraged and drop out from democracy and think that politics is dirty, sleazy, and ineffective. You know, if people aren't turned on politics, politics will turn on them, and that's the lesson of history.
Ralph Nader, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Victor. Stay in touch, folks. It's crashingtheparty.org.
That was Ralph Nader on the Best of the Book Nook, recorded 17 years ago, and he kept mentioning websites like crashingtheparty.org. Well, if you search for those, most of those websites no longer exist. So if you were looking, I think they're long gone. He also mentioned Tony Mazzocco. He said I should interview Tony, who was the head of the Labor Party. I looked up Tony. He died later that year in October of 2002. I never did get the chance to talk to him. One thing really stands with me, though, from that interview, and that's where Ralph Nader said, we should become good ancestors. And now, 17 years later, as we look around us, are we going to become good ancestors? Are we leaving a better planet than the one that we found for our children and grandchildren? I've got one more segment coming up on the Book Nook, a little surprise for you right after this. One more segment left, and we have a special bonus for you from the Best of the Book Nook, my interview with Robert Morgan, recorded back in 2001, the poet and novelist talking about his craft.
I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina on a farm in the 40s and 50s, and I really come from a world where we did not have a car or truck or tractor in those days, and actually plowed with a horse and gathered corn with a horse and wagon, kept our milk and butter in the spring house. But that world began to change rapidly in the 1950s. And by the time I went off to college in 1961, my world was pretty much like everybody else's. We did have a car and truck. I went off to NC State University to study aerospace engineering and applied mathematics. This was the era of the space program and beat the Russians. Remember those times?
Sputnik.
Well, I wanted to be a rocket scientist, but I also was very interested in writing and composing music and all kinds of things. I'd never graduated from high school. I got into college without graduating, but was admitted with a deficiency in solid geometry. And I was doing well in my math classes, advanced calculus, differential equations, that sort of thing. I went into my advisor and said, I want to accelerate. I want to take a more advanced course in differential equations. And he got out my transcript and said, well, you know, you never made up your deficiency in solid geometry. I'm not going to let you accelerate. So that freed up a time slot. Engineering school had a heavy load then, as now. And I noticed in that time slot, I could take English 222, creative writing, with the novelist Guy Owen. And I signed up for that. Owen was a fantastic teacher. He gave me advice the first week that I'm still passing on to students. He'd say things like, listen to the voices around you. Get the living idiom. Know what the inflections are, the significant inflections of speech, so you can get the voice in your writing. He said things like, learn the names of things. It's better to say oak tree than just tree. Better still to say white oak or post oak. What Henry James calls solidity of specification. Well, I wrote a little story for Guy Owen about my great-grandmother, whom I had known when I was 5 or 6 years old, and she was in her 90s. She could remember the Civil War. I actually knew somebody who could remember the Civil War. And she loved to tell about how when she was a little girl, very young, she was taken out of the mountains of North Carolina down to Walterboro, South Carolina, to be safe during the Civil War, because her mother knew the mountains would be overrun by outlaws, deserters. And they were safe down there until spring of 1865, when Sherman got to Savannah and turned north. And remember what he said when he got to the South Carolina line, this is where this thing started, I'm going to pour it to them. And he did. She could remember bodies being brought and laid on the porch and blood dripping down and dogs coming and licking the bodies. Well, I wrote this story about her and about going to visit her when I was a little kid. Took it into class. Guy Owen read it, and he announced to the class, when I read this story, I wept. No math teacher had ever said anything like that to me. And I was hooked at seeing the effect of my writing on a reader, on a sophisticated reader. So in a sense, I never looked back. I did take some more physics classes and math classes, but my heart wasn't in it. I was thinking from then on about writing. And transferred to UNC Chapel Hill the next year, published some short stories, but discovered poetry in the late 60s. I had not known much about poetry. Now, these are the days of the civil rights movement and readings against the Vietnam War, that sort of thing. The poets were in fashion then. Poetry readings were a big thing. I just fell in love with poetry and started writing poetry, publishing it, so that by the time I was 23, 24 years old, I was publishing poems in national magazines. The poetry was rapidly reinforced. And when I was 26, working as a house painter in Western North Carolina, Cornell University offered me a job teaching poetry workshops. So I went to Cornell in upstate New York. I'd never lived outside the South before that. I went there as a visiting lecturer for 1 year, replacing a senior poet who was on leave. They invited me to stay one more year, and then the chair called me in to his office in the spring of 1973 and said, would you like to be a professor? It paid better than house painting, so I said, certainly, and have been at Cornell ever since. They promoted me quickly and very high, and though I've spent a lot of time in the South, I have really lived in upstate New York since then. Now, in the early 1980s, I had been promoted at Cornell. I had published a number of books of poetry, but I knew I wanted to get back to fiction writing for two reasons, really. I wanted to catch some of the voices I had heard as a child. I'd never been able to do that in poetry. My poems were in my voice. I had never been able to write poems in somebody else's voice. Also, I wanted to tell some of the stories I'd heard by the fireplace, on the porch, from my grandpa, from my dad, from my mother, from my uncles, all these stories about panthers and snakes and spiders and ghosts and moonshiners and the Civil War. So I began to write prose. Narrative prose. But I had been away from it so long that it took me years to really get into it and to learn the craft, to begin to learn the craft of fiction writing. I didn't really publish a short story until 1987, when a friend of mine asked to see a short story, and I showed him one, and he said, oh, we'll publish it. So I started sending out short stories. Some of them got taken, and in 1988, I'd heard that Peachtree Publishers in Atlanta published Southern fiction. So I sent a little book called The Blue Valleys to them, and in about 3 weeks, they wrote back and said, we want to do it. So that book came out in 1989 and got more reviews and sold more copies in the first month than all my books of poetry put out. I realized just how big the audience for fiction was compared to the audience for poetry. Another important breakthrough for me happened the same year, 1989. I was doing research for a novel I wanted to write based loosely on the life and death of my Uncle Robert in a B-17 crash in World War II. I interviewed pilots. I went to England and found the site of the crash. I studied B-17 manuals and read histories of the 8th Air Force. But I got so bogged down in the technicalities, I couldn't start that novel. One day I said to myself, maybe I'll let the fiancée of this soldier tell part of the story. I'll alternate. And I started dreaming my way into this character. She's now in her 70s. It's the 1980s. She's at a nursing home in Western North Carolina. She's lost a foot. She's going through physical therapy. And she's remembering 1941, 1942, seeing her fiancé off, getting the telegram that he's been killed. And I was so scared, writing in the voice of a woman. What did I know about how this woman would talk, how she would think? I think I was so scared I worked twice as hard as I ever had at writing to get away from myself, away from my voice, and into her voice. I wanted to have it so that you could see everything from her point of view and hear it in her words. She was narrating the story. By the time I got 30 pages of that, I knew it was the best thing I'd ever written. And I discovered something very important about fiction writing, which is that it's not self-expression, it's the expression of your characters and their story. You escape yourself into your characters, into their world, their point of view, their voices, their words. It became the novella, The Mountains Won't Remember Us. And I knew it was the best thing I'd ever done. It was the beginning of my writing longer fiction, and particularly longer fiction in first person, and often from the point of view of the woman character.
In case you've just tuned in, my guest is Robert Morgan. His new book is called This Rock. I think the thing that impressed me the most about this book, Robert, is I never heard your voice, ever.
Now, the key for me for writing fiction is to get the voice of the character, to get away from my voice, to forget all those lectures I've given and the poetry I've written and critical essays, to get back to the voice of the time I'm writing about. This Rock is set in the 1920s. It's in the age of Prohibition. It's narrated first by Jenny Powell, who narrates my novel, The Truest Pleasure. It's a kind of sequel to The Truest Pleasure. In The Truest Pleasure, Jenny's husband, Tom, dies. She's now a widow. And she picks up her story about 15 years later, talking about widowhood and raising her children, particularly her teenage sons, Muir and Moody. About two-thirds of the book is narrated by Muir, the younger son, who is an obsessive person. He feels he has the call to preach. He fails at that miserably. He still feels he has a call, a vocation, a destiny he's got to fulfill. He's an obsessive person. In contrast to Muir is his older brother Moody, who is a moonshiner and a heavy drinker and very irreverent. He's always mocking his brother Muir. Mama says Muir feels he has the call to preach, he has the call. Moody says the only call Muir feels is the call of nature. He's always saying something resentful or irreverent. Now, when I began This Rock, I thought that Moody would be a minor character. He would just be there as kind of foil to Muir and his sense of the call. But as I got into the story, I became increasingly interested in Moody. Why is he so angry? Why is he so irreverent? Why does he want to mock everybody, including himself? And as the story went on, I got more and more interested in going deeper into his character. And to some extent, he took over the book. He took the book away from me. They say that Blake once said that of Paradise Lost, that Milton was of the devil's company without knowing it, that Satan became the hero, and something like that happened to me writing this book.
I felt some very heavy underlying themes. Obviously, moonshine is one of them. You're writing about what you know here. And another thing is the Baptist faith and Baptist guilt. There's a lot of guilt there under the surface for these two sons.
Well, I have avoided writing about moonshining before this book because it's such a stereotypical thing for the Southern Appalachians. But since this story is set in the age of Prohibition and is loosely based on family stories, I felt I had to write about it now. Once I decided to talk about bootlegging and moonshining, I realized I didn't have to do a lot of research. It had been such a family business. One of my grandpas was a moonshiner. Several of my uncles actually were arrested and did time in the Atlanta Penitentiary. And some of my cousins also in the 50s up into my lifetime were involved in the business. So I discovered I didn't have to go far. I knew a lot about making liquor and selling it.
Now, didn't you have a cousin that drove down the middle of the road with his still in his truck? Was that your cousin?
That was my cousin who had actually been a bootlegger during World War II on New Caledonia. He had gotten through the war making moonshine for the officers in the Army. He became so confident or overconfident in the 1950s that he moved his still in the back of his pickup truck in daylight with bring it up. He just drove up the road, and he was arrested a few weeks later. Somebody obviously turned him in. But I also made up my mind when I began to write The Truest Pleasure, the predecessor of this book, that I would write about religion, as you say, the Baptist religion and the Pentecostal holiness religion, because they are so important to this society, and particularly in this period. Once I decided I would write about it, I decided I would do it from inside. I would not try to stand aside as a college professor looking back and being ironic and judgmental, but I would try to get into the mind of Jenny, who takes part in these Pentecostal services. She speaks in tongues. She dances and shouts. And I would try to communicate the actual experience of those ecstatic services. The inspiration for writing Gap Creek, which is about Julie and Hank Richards, was to write about a woman, Julie, who not only spends her life working for other people, but who believes that she shows her Christianity through how she lives, not what she says, not what she does at a meeting the way the other woman, Jenny, does. So I tried to take it more from the Baptist point of view in Gap Creek. In This Rock, it is again the Baptist point of view, but in the case of Muir and Jenny, people who are not in such good standing with the Baptist because they're connected to the Pentecostal holiness or have been connected. So I wanted to talk about that kind of controversy. I grew up with in a world where churches were constantly splitting, there would be disagreements about doctrine, and yes, people are often driven by their sense of guilt. Muir, particularly in This Rock, I think is driven by his sense of just not measuring up. He's not as good a person as he thinks he should be. To be a preacher, to build a great church on top of a mountain, it's one of his. And one of the reasons I chose the title, This Rock, is not only that he wants to build that church on top of a mountain, out of rock, he's going to get out of the river, but the passage in Matthew where Jesus says, upon this rock I will build my church. Now the rock he's talking about is Peter, and Peter is no saint. He later was declared a saint, but Peter is the one who just goes crazy on the mountaintop and starts saying silly things. Peter's the one with the short temper who chops off a man's ear in the Garden of Gethsemane, and Jesus has to put it back up. He's the one who denies Jesus three times before the cock crows. So he's a very imperfect person. But that's the rock.
That was Robert Morgan, recorded back in 2001, talking about his novel, This Rock. That was his first visit to the Book Nook, and I loved what he had to say about writing and about poetry and about how he became a novelist. You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. For The Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.